Right now, think of a barbershop and you might think of clippers and scissors and close shaves. A barbershop in Milwaukee is offering local kids a lot more than just a haircut. They may walk away with a book and free back-to-school supplies on top of a sharp-looking haircut.
Books in barbershops is an effort to help boost literacy and also to help close Milwaukee's pervasive black and white achievement gap, which is among the highest in the nation.
The program hopes to foster a love of reading in young children who might find themselves a little at loose ends after school.
Books in Barbershops is a partnership between city officials, the Milwaukee Public Library, and the owner of Chicago Cuts, a Midtown Milwaukee barbershop. Ronald Bell, the owner of Chicago Cuts, joins us now. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Veronica.
Well, first of all, can you paint a picture for us? How does this work? A child comes into the barbershop. What happens?
Well, you know, first off, the main thing we're trying to do is close that achievement gap between blacks and whites. And, you know, I was just really trying to figure out the best location or the best way to reach them. And, you know, for the African-American community, the barbershop is somewhat like a country club to us. You know, we exchange a lot of ideas, energy, and, you know, that's just a great meeting place. So usually when the child first comes in, they're just caught off guard by the interior design. We invested a lot of money into the decor. You know, it really looks like you're walking into the south side of Chicago, from the L train to the downtown city skyline. Every child that's been in there, they told me that they, you know, don't want to go to any other barbershop but mine. And then we have a bookcase where, you know, we have comic books and, you know, different type of magazines from the Smithsonian Library and, you know, just a large variety of different things. And, you know, we just try to make it fun for kids. You know, we have some books that are, you know, 10 pages long, some books that are 20, 30 pages long. But, you know, we just basically just try to make it fun for them, you know, just where it's not school books where they're trying to read up on history or geography.
How did you decide to get involved and bring this to Chicago Cuts?
Well, obviously I'm from Chicago, you know, with the name Chicago Cuts. And, you know, at one point in life, I really wasn't where I'm at mentally now. And sports really saved my life. And having different mentors, different coaches, and, you know, different people that help guide me through life, it really helped develop me into the man I am today. So I have three sons myself, and my fourth son will be here actually on October 11th. And I'm just trying to, you know, just find a way for, you know, us to just, I guess, add value within the black community and, you know, just try to redirect their energy into something else, you know?
And so if a child comes into the barbershop and they see not only, the stuff of the hair cutting and the look of Chicago, they see these bookshelves and they see comic books. How do you work with them about picking something they like and getting excited about reading it?
Oh, well, to be honest with you, the first step before we even go to the bookshelf, I actually have a 150-gallon saltwater fish tank that's in the wall, and I take all the kids over there, and, you know, that's a different aspect of education. You know, I teach them about the different types of saltwater fish. You know, first thing they say is, oh, where's Nemo? And, you know, we just kind of go over the different names, and, you know, I let them feed the fish, and I just try to get them comfortable within the shop. We have several flat-screen TVs, and we have, you know, different cartoons for them for different age groups. And, you know, I don't just take them straight to the bookshelf. We just try to, you know, get them comfortable walking around, have a good time. And then, you know, at that point, to be honest with you, they end up leading me over to the books. And then at that point, I ask them, like, what's your favorite, comic book character, X-Men, Batman, Superman? And, you know, really at that point, they just take over, and I really just follow their lead.
So it sounds like, in a sense, you're a guide and a mentor for these kids who come in. This is kind of a community place. It's not just a place of books or a place of haircuts. There's more going on. I mean, do you see yourself as a mentor?
To be honest with you, the reason that I opened up Chicago Cuts, you know, I'm definitely a businessman, but this investment right here, it was not really about the money. This was more so about investing into the minds of these young African-American kids. I really do feel like a big brother, and, you know, it's just with this barbershop, this is like a hub for me to reach the masses instead of me by myself reaching out and trying to do different community service events at the YMCA or, you know, going to schools to speak or this and that. I have more control having my own business, my own land, and, you know, just my own environment for them. And, you know, like, think about it. You guys found out about me and reached out to me, and now we're on Wisconsin, you know, public radio. So I know that this is going into the right direction. And, you know, I've been getting a lot of people that come and visit, and, you know, everyone just supports me. And, you know, they've been asking me for ideas for what they can do in their community. And, you know, I got other barbershop owners in other areas. You know, we're trying to work together to, you know, basically just bring peace and bring education within the Black community.
And you launched the program, as I understand it, earlier this month in time for getting kids back to school. How is it working so far?
Man, it's working great, to be honest with you. I got people coming from all different type of cities. Like one of my barbers, his name is Cedric. If you want to follow him on Instagram, it's Ced the Barber. And he told me that a lady actually called him from West Bend, and that's about a 45-minute drive away from Milwaukee. And she said that she had a local barber for her son, but she just wanted to come check out the interior design. And she just really wanted to let her son and see what was going on. She just wanted him to just have the experience of walking through and just seeing everything that's going on within the area.
I'm talking right now with Ron Bell, the owner of Chicago Cuts Barbershop in Midtown Milwaukee, and he's talking about a new program there to boost literacy by making books and school supplies free to kids. And these books that you've got there, you mentioned some comic books. So where do they come from? Are they donated?
Yes, we've teamed up with the mayor, Tom Barrett, Alderman Cavalier Johnson, and he's actually connected me with the Milwaukee Public Library, and they bring me a certain amount of books every so often, and if we run low, they'll restock it. But the way I basically set it up now, my barbershop is somewhat like a library, because some kids, they come in and they may take a book that day, and, you know, it's really just an honor system. I don't have any type of tracking to see what book was taken and what kid took it, but they usually come back for that next haircut appointment. They'll return that book and then take out a new one.
Do you ever have conversations with the kids who are reading through maybe a series in comic books about what they read?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's the main thing, is just being a part, you know, because, you know, it's sad to say, you know, most of the African-American males, you know, they're, you know, either incarcerated or, you know, sad to say, some of them are, you know, not even with us anymore. They passed away. So it's a lot of these kids growing up without that guidance. So, you know, that's why I explained to you, you know, maybe ever since I started having kids and maybe I got, you know, more love around me and stuff, I really want to try to help as many kids as possible, because I just know the small amount of help that I was given from all my mentors and coaches, you know, it just helped develop me into this. And, you know, if I can just spark that idea in one of these kids' mind, I just know that they can, you know, I can create another one of myself, or, you know, someone better than me to, you know, really reach the masses and, you know, try to just create a positive change within the community.
Now, in the traditional education system and communities, usually the place where the stuff you're happening talks about, it happens, I should say, is the library. People go to the school library or the public library. They check out a book. What do you think is different about your setting that it's getting kids to open up and read more and maybe be more receptive than they might have been?
Well, you know, the library is, you know, you have to be very quiet. You know, that's a place where you do significant amount of studying. But, you know, within a barbershop, it's more fun. I guess that's the key. I'm bringing more, I'm bringing a lot more fun and a lot more of this 2016 up-to-date, you know, swag, or, you know, just the, you know, just everything that's going on within the Black community. It's not boring. I'm making sure that they're having a good time, because, you, at the end of the day, I want to see real results. You know, I'm not... you know, I really want to make sure that we really affect the masses in the right way. So I say the difference is we make it a lot more fun. And, you know, we may take a break. Like I said, we have several flat screens. We have a PS4 in there. You know, we may end up playing 2K17 with the kids. And, you know, and even when they put the book down, we're talking about, man, so what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, and just trying to spark that idea so they start thinking about it now, instead of, you know, they're 18, 19, 20 in college trying to pick a major.
Do you plan to do any kind of tracking with this, see if the kids who are part of your community there at the books and barbershops, whether they do go on to score better in school or go to high school and college, see if it's having an effect?
Well, I think I want to really just let the program kind of go through the grunt period right now. We just want to really just get the name out there and just let people know what's going on. And then I would say within a couple of months, maybe within the school year, we'll probably start to do the tracking within like second quarter, third quarter of grades. But, you know, right now I don't think that we've reached the amount of people yet to do the tracking. I want to just make sure that we really just get it across the city and try to get as many kids reading. And then once I get more people to come in on a regular basis, then I'll probably get in contact with their schools and, you know, give out rewards. Or, you know, so if someone increased their GPA, you know, you get free, like 5 free haircuts. Or, you know, I'm going to try to figure out some type of incentive to make them want to learn. And, you know, even have, you know, like contests within the barbershop. Like, let's say on a Saturday on one of our more busier days, I'll have 5 kids, you know, and whoever can read this book the fastest, or, you know, whoever doesn't mind reading this book in front of the group, you'll get, you know, this amount of haircuts. Or, you know, we'll figure out some type of incentive for them to make the whole process fun.
And Ron, just briefly as we wrap up, what would you say to other business owners who might be interested in taking on something like this?
Well, if anyone is interested in doing that, you can definitely reach out to us on our website, www.chicagocuz.com, you know, Facebook page, Yelp page, anything. But, you know, feel free to contact me. You know, teamwork makes the dream work. Anyone that wants to reach out to me and we try to build this up within the city, that's what I'm here for. You know, I'm definitely trying to just make a change within the inner city.
Ron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much. You enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. That was Ron Bell, the owner of Chicago Cuts Barbershop in Midtown Milwaukee. And he joined us there to talk about a new program to boost literacy by making books and school supplies free to kids. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Central Wisconsin has seen an increase in methamphetamine confiscations. We'll hear why there's been a sudden rise.
First, astronomer Tyler Nordgren's new book chronicles the history of solar eclipses, from the astrologers of ancient China and Babylon to the so-called eclipse chasers of today, who are already preparing for next year's continent-spanning solar eclipse.
Tyler's new book is Sun, Moon, Earth, the history of solar eclipses from omens of doom to Einstein and exoplanets. Tyler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you've looked at a lot of things up in the sky, and solar eclipses, it sounds like, are one of your most exciting favorite things out there. Why is that?
It is a multi-century experience that is just like anything else that you encounter in nature. And when I finally got a chance to see one, it absolutely blew me away. I knew what was going on, but I could not believe what I was seeing.
Can you describe what that was like?
So as the moon passes in front of the sun, if you are lucky enough to be in one of those special places on Earth that where it happens each year, the temperature drops, the sky grows dark, the lighting turns strange, colors kind of bleach out of things, and then at the moment of totality, you go from what had been a day to suddenly night, as if it was an hour after sunset. The brighter stars and planets come out, and suddenly the sun turns black, and its outer atmosphere, this corona that is like these wispy tendrils that come out. Normally they're utterly invisible, but at the moment of totality, suddenly they're visible, and you're staring up at this strange black hole in the sky, and there is nothing else like it.
Let's get into the science a little, and the timing. These are rare, which always used to confuse me, because I think, oh, the moon, it's going around every 28 days. Why aren't we having a solar eclipse every 28 days? Not quite that simple, though, I guess.
Unfortunately, the moon's orbit is tilted about 5 degrees with respect to the Earth traveling around the sun. So most every month, the moon just passes invisibly beneath the sun from our vantage point here on Earth. But twice each year, when the moon crosses in front, it's possible to have eclipses. They're called eclipse seasons. So twice each year, you will have lunar eclipses where the moon travels into the Earth's shadow, and then solar eclipses will occur 2 weeks before, 2 weeks after that, when the moon travels in front of the sun. So they happen each year. It's just a matter of where are they visible. And with solar eclipses, you have to be at a special place on Earth where that small shadow of the moon happens to cross over.
And I have to say, while you were just describing what it's like during one, I mean, you can see why ancient peoples might have thought the world was coming to an end. It sounds like it's extraordinary.
Absolutely. I was lucky enough to be living in Portland, Oregon in 1979 when the last one that touched the continental U.S. happened. Unfortunately, it was cloudy, and I was so terrified from the local news reports about burning your eyes out that I hid indoors. And it took me 20 more years before I happened to see one as a professional astronomer in Hungary in 1999. And so I prepared my entire life for this. And yet when it happened, the hair stood up on the back of my neck, and I understood why people would sacrifice slaves or their opponents and enemies in order to bring that sun back again.
Now, these have been scary to people, signs of impending doom, but they've also been, it sounds like, really useful to scientists going back as far as ancient Greece. Can you talk about the benefits of eclipses for science?
Well, one of the first actual calculations that we have of somebody using a solar eclipse to figure out something about our world is when someone in Greece, Anaxagoras, figured out that if a solar eclipse was just the moon blotting out the sun, then the shadow that was cast on the Earth should tell you something about the size of the moon. If you could measure the extent of that shadow across the landscape, you knew that the moon had to be larger. And by going down to the local port and interviewing sailors who came in, he could ask, where were you? Did you actually see this when it happened? And by plotting out where people had and had not seen it, he figured out that the moon had to be at least as large as Greece. So there's one of the first instances of this idea that they could tell us something about our physical world. And then after that, people learned that by precisely timing when they occurred and where, you could compare that with predictions and figure out where you were on the Earth. And eventually, when scientists finally started really paying attention to what was going on, we began to learn something about the features, the geography, if you will, of the sun itself.
You tell a great story in the book about Columbus using the way that we can predict eclipses to his own benefit. It's a story you've never heard before. Could you tell us a quick version of it?
So one of the things that Columbus had done is he had these almanacs of when various celestial events would happen, and these almanacs were all tabulated for a time back in Europe, a location in Europe. And if you know when something happens in Europe and you know when something, that exact same thing, is happening for you locally, that difference in, say, Greenwich time and your local time, that time difference tells you essentially how many degrees across the Earth you are. For every hour of difference, it's 15 degrees eastward or westward across the planet. Well, Columbus was in Jamaica, and he was shipwrecked, and things were going bad. His men had been plundering the local inhabitants, and so he was in danger of this not only a mutiny, but a revolt of the locals. And he went and looked at his almanacs and realized that there was this prediction of a lunar eclipse when the moon passes into the Earth's shadow and the moon turns blood red. And he did some calculations based on where he thought he was and these almanacs, and he figured out that there was a good chance that lunar eclipse would be visible that night. And so he told the locals, gathered the chieftains, and said, God is unhappy with you, and to show his displeasure, he's going to make the moon turn blood red, and only if you repent and start bringing me food again will I intercede and bring the moon back. And sure enough, it happened. And so this was an instance of using modern technology, modern knowledge, to scare other cultures that were less knowledgeable about the events. And one can arguably say it changed the course of history.
We're talking to Tyler Nordgren about eclipses, solar and otherwise. He's the author of the new book, Sun, Moon, Earth. And Tyler, this is exciting because we've got a big one coming up next year, next August. I imagine you're keeping your schedule wide open for interviews leading up to that. Tell us about this upcoming eclipse.
So on August 21st of next summer, there's going to be the first total solar eclipse to cross the continental U.S., since 1979. And if you think about the median age for the U.S. population is about 38. So roughly half the people alive this year in the U.S. were not alive the last time something like this happened here. And on that day, August 21st, the shadow of the moon is going to cross from the coast of Oregon diagonally across the country, across St. Louis, and then out through South Carolina. And so while only people in this narrow diagonal band about 100 miles wide north and south, but stretching from Oregon to South Carolina, we'll see this. Everybody else in the United States is going to get at least a partial eclipse that day, so they'll be able to see part of the sun being blocked. And so this really is going to be something that every single man, woman, and child in America is going to be experiencing together.
And apparently, I mean, some places it sounds like it's an incredible boon to the tourist industry. People are booking rooms, what, years in advance to see this at its peak?
Exactly. You take a look at small towns all along this path of totality. I've been working with folks out in Oregon, and they say, yes, the hotels have been booked up. Towns that have a population of about 5,000 are hearing that potentially 20,000 are going to show up on that day. And it's one of the things about this totality is if you follow the path, it crosses through a lot of beautiful countryside, and it misses some really big towns. So it's a lot of wonderful rural, small-town parts of America that are going to get to experience this, and it will be amazing for the local economy.
We'll have a lot of time to figure this out, I guess, Tyler, but you always hear how you are and aren't supposed to view a solar eclipse. In a nutshell, what should we do when the time comes?
Okay, so on that day, if any part of the sun is visible, so if the eclipse is not completely total, then the sun is virtually as bright as any other day of the year. And so you wouldn't stare at the sun on any regular day, so you don't want to stare at the sun on that day. In order to see that partial phase of the eclipse, you'll need some special glasses. And these things cost about $1, maybe $2. You can find them online. If you're in the path of totality, virtually every store is going to have these. And with them, that partial phase of the eclipse will be totally safe, completely safe. If you do manage to be in that path of totality, when the moon finally does perfectly cover the sun, you can take your glasses off, and it will be just awe-inspiring. It'll be no brighter than the full moon, in fact. And so just absolutely wonderful.
And, Tyler, before we let you go, where are you going to be? Where did you decide to watch it?
Well, I still have family up in Oregon, and so I'm going to be out in eastern Oregon, out in the wonderful canyon country out there, and just making a full weekend of it. And since a solar eclipse happens when the moon is in front of the sun, the evenings right before and right after are the darkest nights of the year, and the summer Milky Way will be overhead, and so far away from any city lights, it's going to be spectacular, both by day and night.
Wow, sounds amazing. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Tyler Nordgren, the author of Sun, Moon, Earth, The History of Solar Eclipses from Omens of Doom to Einstein and Exoplanets. He's a physics professor at the University of Redlands in California.
Are you going to try to go and watch this somewhere?
I am. Could you hear the wheels of my brain turning?
Just stay well clear of me, because I can guarantee it will be cloudy that day. Incredibly cloudy wherever I happen to be.
All right. Clear of Rob. Check.
Well, coming up, a local police chief tells us about the rise of methamphetamine use in central Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
From regular hand washing to sterilized bottles, antibiotics to antibacterial soaps, we have done a lot to keep our kids as germ-free as possible.
Our next guest says there have been a lot of benefits from modern hygiene, but we often take things too far. Instead of treating microbes as the enemy, more and more scientific evidence points toward the benefits of the bacteria that live among us and inside of us. And if we try too hard to wipe out the bad stuff, we can lose the benefits of the good stuff.
Marie Claire Arrieta joins us now. She's a microbiologist and assistant professor at the University of Calgary, and she's the co-author of the new book, Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. Marie Claire, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it seems like there's this big attitude change toward microbes, where a lot of us, at least in the popular culture, thought of them as the enemy, something to be eradicated as much as possible, to seeing them as providing a lot of benefits, being important to who we are and how we come into being.
That's right. So all microbes cannot be put under the same umbrella. Rightly so, some of them are, you know, to be feared because they cause very dangerous in infections, but we live in most industrialized countries and societies that that exposes to a very reduced risk for these infections, thanks to hygiene measures, thanks to vaccines, and thanks to antibiotics. And all of these are wonderful ways of reducing the risk of disease. But I think we've gone too far, as you were saying before in the introduction. Microbes also are part of who we are. And this is a new side of microbes that we didn't know about until up to about 10 years ago. They really are part of our bodies. We rely on microbes, especially as children, to perform essential tasks for our development, like the maturation of our immune system, regulating how we spend energy, how we store fats, like really important stuff that we cannot do without microbes.
A lot of what you're writing seems to be a good news, bad news story. I mean, the good news is sanitation, hygiene, antibiotics have helped stop a lot of really horrible diseases in the industrial countries anyway. But along with that, because of some of what we've done to the good microbes, you're right that we're seeing rises in asthma, in autoimmune disorders. Can you talk about some of the consequences there?
Yeah. So basically, since we realized that microbes perform such important tasks for our immune system and our metabolism early on, what happens is if we miss out or we deplete this exposure of microbes early on, we do not get the proper training necessary for our immune system or our metabolism. So there's study after study showing that if you receive antibiotics during the first year of life or even during the late phases of pregnancy, that very strongly associates with a baby later on going to develop asthma, allergies, obesity, diabetes, autoimmune disease, many different diseases, all associated to these changes in what we call the microbiome or this community of microbes in early life. Along with antibiotic use is, for example, a C-section. We never thought of a C-section being as detrimental for health, but it happens that when we're born via C-section, we miss out on that first bath of microbes that normally we would obtain through vaginal and fecal secretions during a vaginal birth. So just by being born via C-section, that increases the chances between 15 to 30% of developing asthma and allergies.
One thing that makes it hard to talk about this, I think, is you're making the case that we've gone too far, but you're also trying to say we can't overcorrect and go in the other direction. We don't want to completely throw away the antibiotics or the hand washing or C-sections for that matter are sometimes medically necessary.
They are. And, we have to be realistic, right? We live in a modern society. And vaccines, this is such an important point to make because vaccines is one of the only public health measures that we have to prevent some of the worst infections. And without vaccines, they will come back, as it has happened in countries where vaccinations rates have gone down. So we depend on these types of measures to try and prevent some of the most dangerous diseases. With antibiotics, they're a little bit of a double-edged sword because we need them. If we have a bad bacterial infection, there's no way around it. We have to take them. But we really need to restrict their use. Antibiotics are nowadays overused and abused, and one should never push a family doctor to give a child an antibiotic because they do come with side effects. But at the end of the day, what we try to do with the book is to provide information to reach this balance as much as we can between disease prevention and also what we consider a healthy exposure to microbes.
We're talking to Marie-Claire Arrieta. She's co-author of the new book, Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World, talking about kids and germs. And germs are not a dirty word anymore for kids. Marie-Claire, as you were just saying, a lot of your book is aimed at practical advice for parents in particular. I want to get into some of that. Let's talk about how much we should let kids get dirty and go out in the world and put things in their mouths. So one time at a restaurant bar in town, one of my kids, who was then two, we saw she was eating a pickle. She didn't have a pickle. We asked where she got it. It was from the floor. As a parent, I feel some revulsion there. But maybe that wasn't a good example. But maybe we need to not freak out so much when kids are out there exploring the world.
Yeah, it's hard not to freak out. I have two young children, and you get freaked out. The important thing is to understand that not all dirt is equal. So, yes, if you're out in a public space where there's lots of people and you see your child picking something from the ground and putting it in the mouth, it's not a really good idea. There's lots of people there, and whenever there's a high concentration of people, the risk of diseases goes up. But if your child is out in the park or out in the countryside or in your own home, the risk of disease, of contracting a disease, really goes down. So you really can let that go, and it's fine to have your child put something in his or her mouth or to play with dirt. But there's some areas where you have to be a bit careful, you know, a subway station, a crowded mall, those types of things. I think it's important to teach them, you know, do not lick the floor in those places, or wash your hands after you've been playing in the subway floor, if that ever happened, and especially to do it before you eat and after you use the washroom.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about hand washing. It's easy. I certainly get a little, not obsessive about it, but I wash my hands a lot. Where's the right line to draw for kids?
Well, with hand washing, the good is that it's a practice that has been studied really, really well for decades. So we know when it's effective and when it really doesn't make a difference. And it is before we make food and before we eat, after we use the restroom, if we have been in contact with anyone that is sick, if we ourselves are sick to try and prevent other people from getting sick, or if we, for whatever reason, have been in contact with animal waste or with anything that is decomposing. Beyond that, hand washing makes no difference in terms of disease prevention. We know now that we do not need to wash ourselves with antibacterial soap. It's no more effective, and in fact, the FDA just did something really good at banning some of the chemicals that are most common in antimicrobial products. They're really not good for you, and they're not really effective in preventing disease. They do have a place, for example, if you're camping and you do not have a good source of water. But other than that, plain old school soap and water is what you need during those times that I just mentioned.
Yeah, you mentioned antibacterial soap. How about those hand sanitizers? Purell is the brand a lot of people encounter, those alcohol-based hand sanitizers. Are those maybe overkill?
Completely. We do not need them. And again, they don't really work in preventing disease if you continuously use them. We should just aim for regular soap and water. I think anything beyond that is totally over-sanitizing ourselves. And you see them everywhere. Now I have kids in school, and you kind of see them hanging from every other backpack. The same thing with diaper bags. You see them everywhere. There's this idea that the more you clean yourself, the safer you are, when that's just not the case, according to science. So we don't need them, again, unless we're camping or if we're caring for someone that's sick or if we're in a hospital. But for our everyday living, we do not need them.
We've been talking a lot about what not to do. Let's talk about some more positive things. Let's talk about food. Are there foods that parents can keep in mind to promote healthy gut bacteria in particular?
Yes. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how good exposure your kids have with microbes. If you don't feed those microbes the right things, they're going to end up dying anyway. And that's one of the, I call it, crisis that we have in modern society. And it is the type of food that we feed our microbes. Microbes rely on our fiber intake to thrive in our gut. And we nowadays live in a pretty fiber-depleted world. So think about feeding your kids fibers in, you know, natural occurring forms, vegetables and fruits in every single meal, including snacks and breakfast, as well as substituting all the refined grains like rice and wheat with the whole variety. So using brown rice and using whole wheat. And if you substitute all your refined grains for the whole variety, you're already increasing the fiber intake by a ton. So you don't really need to be eating bran cereal all day to eat a good amount of fiber. You just need to eat it throughout the day in the natural occurring forms. So that's the best thing that you can do. And also supplementing with fermented foods. So yogurt, the ones that have live microbes in it, kefir, sauerkraut, pickled vegetables, all those are good.
We're talking about microbes and kids. Our guest is Marie Claire Arrieta. She says we've gone too far in our quest to sanitize the world that our children live in. She's the co-author of the new book, Let Them Eat Dirt.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you handle cleanliness for your kids? And what were things like when you grew up? How much hand washing do you require for your kids? And how dirty do you let them get? Do you think maybe we've gone too far in keeping things clean? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with microbiologist Marie Claire Arrieta, and we're looking at her new book, Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World.
And you could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you super zealous about hand washing and hygiene in your household? Do your kids have opportunities to get dirty? How are things different now compared to your own childhood? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. Paul is on the line in White River. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Paul?
I wanted to say how wonderful this program is. In my life and my people, we have never stressed or focused on microbes or germs. We don't even have a word for them. And I think that it's very important to eat things that are that wouldn't be sanitized. And I think native peoples have always known this, and it wasn't until Europeans came here with the idea of cleanliness their science that they ruined the natural state of things. We bury salmon heads in the ground until they ferment, and we eat them. The salmon head, the cheeks and the forehead and all that, the salmon, and they're very good. And I just think it's another example of how bad science and bad technology from the Europeans have ruined a good life that we had.
Paul, thanks a lot for that call. And Marie Claire, do we see lessons from native cultures, maybe other cultures, where we could learn a thing or two?
Well, it's interesting. Well, to my knowledge, there hasn't been epidemiological studies done, particularly in Native American communities. But there have been plenty of studies done in areas of the world that still keep, you know, traditional form of living, and that they haven't seen the same level of industrialization like we do here in North America or in Europe. And what we see over there is interesting, because what we see is that in places in North Africa, for example, people are still suffering from dangerous infections because, you know, they're not following the same hygiene measures that we do. But interestingly, they do not have the same rates of immune and metabolic diseases that I was talking about before. So it seems that it's either one or the other, depending on where you look at the world. What we think is that ideally, in this part of the world, we can regain, or we are at least hopeful that we can regain that balance in which you can prevent dangerous disease. You do not need to get, you know, dangerous infections, while at the same time, you can harvest a diverse and a strong microbiome. So we don't think it's one or the other.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Jacqueline on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Jacqueline, hi.
Hi there. My question is, why has it taken so long for this to come to the forefront of the public eye? My daughter, 14 years ago, went to the University of Minnesota in microbiology, and she at that time told me to quit using antibacterial soaps and cleaners because it didn't do what they were supposed to be doing, and it was actually, you know, less beneficial to us to be using it. And so if it's that big of an issue, why is it taking so long for people to understand this?
Jacqueline, thanks. Marie Claire, we've been figuring this out about antibacterials for a while now, she says.
Yeah. That's a great question, and it comes down to advances in technology. So it's until very recently that we really understand how critical microbes are to our physiology. They're involved in our behavior, for example. They're involved in how we burn fat, how we store it, and, of course, in the maturation of our immune system. I think before then we thought that they had a role, but we had no idea that it was so important. So I think it's that knowledge that was obtained through advances in technology. Microbiologists like myself, for the longest time, we were only able to study microbes by growing them. And there's only a very small proportion of microbes that grow in the lab. Of all the gut microbes that we have inside of us, about only 10% grow normally in the lab. The rest, we really had no idea, but now we can sequence them. And it's through sequencing that we've really understood how biodiverse is our microbial community in our gut, and that has changed things.
We're talking to Marie-Claire Arrieta, co-author of the new book, Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. Before we go back to our callers, Marie-Claire, talking about how information gets out there, you talk a little bit in the book about media coverage of issues of microbes and things like that, and it doesn't always steer us in the right direction. What do you think is out there?
There's a little bit of everything. I mean, there's some studies that are interpreted the right way. There's some, you know, good science journalists that wouldn't interpret a study as it is. But sometimes that doesn't happen. And at the end of the day, someone that may not have a background in science, it's reading all this information without knowing how to interpret a sometimes pretty complicated study. And that was one of the drivers for us to say, you know what, let's try and synthesize some of the best studies in this field and put it in lay terms for the general audience.
Back to our callers now. Ben is with us in Madison. Ben, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. Say, Marie, I wonder if you would mention briefly helminthic therapy and how that's being used in the West in a limited fashion, partly because the FDA and the medical establishment is conservative, and not in a good way, but in a way that ultimately risks people's health. But what helminthic therapy is and how effective it can be for conditions like Crohn's, and also how that ties back into the hygiene hypothesis.
Marie-Claire, I'm not sure what helminthic therapy is, first of all.
Yeah, so helminths are worms, and they belong to that big group of microbes that live inside of them. And just like with bacteria, there's some, you know, worms that will cause disease, and there's some that don't. Helminths, or these worms, they are known to really modulate or change the way our immune system behaves. The issue with helminthic therapy, as the caller was pointing out, there's some studies saying that it can be used to treat allergic diseases such as asthma or inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's disease. But the literature is a bit what we call noisy. There's some studies saying that it works. There's some studies saying that it does not work. Kind of like the same with probiotics. Probiotics, there's some studies that says that they work and some studies that says that they do not work. The FDA, and of course, they have to wait for the evidence to be sounding enough to recommend such a practice. But there's definitely lots of laboratory groups that are studying helminthic therapy. But I wouldn't go as far as to recommend it just because we do not have enough evidence to say, okay, this is definitely working. I think we might get there, but we need a little bit more time.
Ben, thanks for that call. Marie-Claire, it sounds like in some ways we're standing on the frontier of something that could be really earth-shaking in the way we treat a lot of conditions. We're not there yet. Can you talk about some of the potential future for microbiome, I don't know, therapy, treatment?
Yeah, and you're spot on. We're at the verge of that. This is really groundbreaking science. Again, we didn't know much about this until about a decade ago. But there's a lot going on, so there's huge deals in the pharmaceutical industry, multi-million deals to study different therapies based on the microbiome. So they're studying what they call next generation probiotics. So these are not the probiotics that we find now in natural health stores or in your yogurt. These are species of bacteria that normally we cannot grow in the lab, but we're finding ways of doing so, and we're trying to package them or formulate them to treat disease in kind of like the same way a drug treats disease, and study them and market them that way as well. So there's a huge, huge potential. Research-wise, there's a lot of research dollars that are being devoted to the microbiome field. It's a very exciting field to be in.
We'll leave it there for now. Marie-Claire, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Marie-Claire Arrieta. She's a microbiologist and assistant professor at the University of Calgary. We've been talking about this new book she's co-author of. It's called Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. Some of the lessons, more fiber, more fermented food. Don't worry so much about getting dirty. You can share some of your thoughts and find a little more out about the book over at the Central Time Facebook page.